Thank you. It's a great pleasure to be here. Appreciate the invitation, and I appreciate Bob inviting me to come down. I think he only cut into 2 minutes of my time already, Bob. Okay.
I'll give you 2 extra minutes.
Sweet. Okay, so the title of my talk is going to be The Biology and Management of Corynebora caseicola, Importance for Cotton from a Vegetable Perspective. Okay, well, there's a lot of information out there in Corynebora caseicola, so 20 minutes, I cannot cover everything, but what I'll do is cover some of the high points about biology, a little bit about the history, and what I'll only do is focus on what's been done regards to managing Corynebora caseicola, the causal agent of target spot, in vegetables, in particular tomato. So, Corynebora caseicola. Well, Corynebora caseicola is the type species of the genus Corynebora. There's actually over 100 described species, mostly delineated in part by the host of isolation. And really what this means is there's a lot of people calling things Corynebora with a different species name, and they might actually all be the same. Okay? There's a lot of work that needs to be done. But at this point, if you look through the literature, there's lots of examples of different species of Corynebora. Corynebora caseicola is found on diverse substrates, and this is something I really want to hammer into you, okay? You can find this pathogen in a lot of different places, okay? You can find it on plant leaves, stems, roots. There's even cases where it's been found in nematode cysts. It's a very broad spectrum pathogen. It has a very broad host range of over 530 different plant species from 380 different genera, including monocots, dicots, ferns, and even cycads. Okay, and the pathogenicity of these isolates varies greatly from host to host, and even within a single isolate can be a pathogen of one crop and just a saprophyte of another. Okay, and again, these isolates can also vary as well. Like I said, it can be a saprophyte all the way up to a pathogen, and again, it can depend on what host it's on, what you really get. Here's some images of target spot or diseases caused by Corynebora caseicola on a number of different hosts. Rubber in the center, actually. There's been a lot of work done on rubber because this is a major pathogen on rubber production in Southeast Asia and also in Micronesia. Papaya is a huge issue in the tropics. Also in ornamentals, mandevilla, hibiscus, it's a big problem down in South Florida. And of course, vegetables, cucumber, row crops, soybean. Of course, we're going to hear a lot about cotton. And of course, I'm biased, so it's a very important disease on tomato. I think the other interesting thing about Corynebora caseicola, and you don't find this very often for a lot of plant pathogens, but this is one that's also been found to be a pathogen of humans, mostly, of course, as an opportunistic pathogen for individuals who are immunocompromised. And there's a number of papers. These are just two that I pulled out. And actually, these are some images of a nasty subcutaneous skin infection caused by Corynebora caseicola. You can see it's nice I'm not giving this right before lunch. But here's actually a little arrow. You can actually see they actually see a spore within a section of tissue. Corynebora caseicola does also produce a toxin called caseicolin. It's mostly been studied in regards to the disease on rubber production. These are actually two papers here actually describing the structure of the toxin itself. This is actually the final ones actually where they've actually gone in and actually identified the gene responsible for the production of the toxin. And again, most of this work has been done in relation to rubber trees, okay? Really hasn't expanded into other crops. So there's a lot of work out there that has looked at the genetic and phenotypic diversity of Corynebora caseicola across a number of different crops. But this paper, I think, is probably one of the better ones out there because it actually looks at a global collection across numerous hosts. And this is some work that was done by Lawrence Datinoff, a student of his, Lindsay Dixon, before he left to become the chair over at LSU. In this study, they actually collected 143 isolates from 68 different plant species from all over the world, from America, Samoa, Brazil, Malaysia, Micronesia, and also from numerous locations within the United States, Florida, Mississippi, and Tennessee. These isolates varied And some of them were saprophytic, all the way up to pathogenic on different crops where they isolated it from. They also did a lot of genotyping, where they actually sequenced four different loci within the genus to actually look at the population structure. And they also did some phenotyping as well. And of course, they had 443 isolates that they actually genotyped. Of these 50 isolates, they looked at their pathogen, their host range, and also looked at their growth rate under culture conditions. The hosts they looked at for the pathogenicity studies included basil, bean, cowpea, cucumber, papaya, soybean, sweet potato, and tomato. So this is a really big tree, and basically this is a phylogenetic tree from the genotyping of all these 143 isolates. Okay, and basically what this represents is the relatedness of strains to of one strain to other strains. And what's important to take away from here is what they found is there is a huge amount of diversity. As far as we know, and basically this really demonstrates, is that what we're talking about with Corynaeus borkesiacus is pretty much a clonal pathogen. There was no indication that there was any type of reproduction, any type of Okay, there's no evidence of sexual recombination occurring within these populations. They were pretty much all clonal. And here they actually identified six major groups, PL1, 2, 3, 4, and then there's two smaller ones down here, 5 and 6. Okay, so first shock was that there was considerable genetic diversity, even though this is an asexual pathogen. They identified six phylogenetic lineages that were correlated mostly with host of origin, pathogenicity, and also with growth rate. They found no correlation of genotypes with geographic origin. What that means is that within this group like PL1, they could find isolates in several different regions within the world that all pretty much were genotypically all pretty much the same isolate. Okay, so they could find examples where pretty much the same isolate could be found in several different areas of the world. Okay, so basically it definitely shows that this pathogen moves around quite a bit. Okay. There was no correlation of genotypes with geographic origin. Okay, there was no evidence of adaptation of isolates to environmental conditions. What that means is that they could actually, within this one group, or within these different groups of isolates, they could find examples of that isolate having a higher or less sensitive to higher temperatures versus the same ice or similar isolates collected in more temperate regions. Okay, and they also found common genotypes of relationship. Okay, and let's see, sorry about this. And they also found a lot of evidence to support that there was a lot of host specialization. And so this is pretty much the exact same tree, except it's just divided in two, so you can see. And everywhere where you see these colored dots is actually those are the isolates that they actually went in and did the pathogenicity test on the different hosts. And so here you can see within PL1 versus PL4, PL1, all these orange ones here are actually where they found that these isolates were able to cause disease on papaya versus yellow and green, which is cowpea and cucumber here. So you can see that a lot of these isolates were able to affect a certain range of specific hosts compared to isolates from like this group PL4, which is a lot more diverse, able to cause disease on tomato, cucumber, and in this case, sweet potato as well. All right. But interestingly, so within these groups, you could find that they have very similar pathogenicity profiles, but they also found that some isolates, like some of these papaya isolates, were very specific to just papaya. And there was actually a couple examples in tomato as well, where isolates were just specific to just tomato. So it's very interesting that you have isolates that display a very large host range, able to cause disease on numerous hosts, and then you have other isolates that seem to be very, very host specific. Okay, other than the work of Dixon and Datanoff, there's really been little characterization of Corynaeus borkesiacus in the United States. It's pretty much been mostly considered a subtropical tropical pathogen. Hence, most of the work that has been done is really focused on rubber production in Southeast Asia. For the U.S., it's really just been mostly considered a Florida problem. Okay, and actually, in tomatoes, it was documented back in 1972 outbreaks of Corynebra occurring on tomato. Going back to target spot tomato again, typically the disease requires high humidity, rain or dew for infection. It's easily dispersed by wind. In general, disease development is favored by high temperatures, typically, you know, upper 80s, lower 90s, and long periods of high moisture, 16 to 44 hours. But kind of like what I showed you before, there is definitely some evidence that some isolates are more adapted to higher temperature than the other isolates. So it's fairly a broad range if you look at the genus itself or the species Corynebra cassiacola itself. But each isolate is going to have a specific regime of temperatures that's going to favor it. However, they pretty much all require long periods of high moisture, 16 to 44 hours. And of course, under favorable conditions can lead to extreme amounts of foliar damage on tomatoes. The lesions are very similar. It's pretty amazing when you start looking at different pictures of lesions across the different homes. They're very, very similar, where they typically have almost kind of a tannish, sometimes darker center with little concentric rings around it. A very typical lesion for associated with fungal pathogens. Some cases you do see some chlorosis, usually very limited to the margin of the lesions. Sometimes you don't, and this might be related to how much of the host toxin is actually being produced. Really haven't seen a lot of work looking into that. Produces, like I said, this is an asexual pathogen. There is no sexual stage known of this pathogen, and the phylogenetics of the global population really backs that up. Produces mostly conidia, which are long hyaline with 4 to 20 pseudocepta. They form either singly or in chains of 2 to 6. And the interesting thing is they have a very pronounced hilum, which is up in here. Here's a little bit better close where you can really see that at that base of that conidia. Okay. Of course, it's not just limited to foliage on tomato and other crops. It also affects fruit. In this case, on tomato, you can see produces these really nice lesions that can get very, very large and get kind of a star cracking. That's what we kind of use to identify this out in the field. Typically, though, for most growers, it's usually these nice little small lesions that we get. And the interesting thing, at least on tomato production, for fresh market tomato, usually they're staked to about 4 foot tall. And what happens a lot of times when you have these outbreaks is that from the outside of the canopy, because it's usually fairly dry, you see no evidence of the disease at all. But once you open up the inside of that canopy, it's pretty much all blighted out from target spot, because inside that canopy, you have that nice high humid and it stays nice and wet for those long periods of time that you need for the spores to germinate and cause a lot of disease. And typically what will happen is when you look at the fruit, the outside of the fruit that's exposed to the outside of the canopy looks perfectly fine, but you take that fruit and you turn it over and it'll literally just be blasted by lesions caused by target spot. And of course, it's very easy for growers to misidentify this or mistake this for other diseases, such as anthracnose on tomato. And then another one it's commonly confused with is another disease is early blight caused by different alternaria species on tomato as well. So here you can see those nice target spot lesions. I'm sure those look fairly familiar to you, versus something like early blight, which is caused by a different fungus. So target spot tomato management, of course, crop rotation, we always have recommend growers to avoid rotations among susceptible crops. And of course, from some of the work I've showed you for host range, that can be pretty challenging. Luckily for us, at least most tomato growers, that's pretty much all they do is just tomatoes. We do have some growers that do some rotations with cucurbits. Question is, are they running into more problems with this because of that? And we really can't tell. Sanitation, of course, I think this probably plays a larger role in this than what people often underestimate, and so we always recommend to growers to destroy their plant debris and volunteers. It's very easy for this fungus to carry over from crop to crop on debris. And of course, weeds are also a likely reservoir, but again, because of the broad host range, it's really hard to identify exactly which weed to make specific recommendations. So most growers are fairly good about making sure they manage weeds, period, because of all the other pathogens that can be carried over on weeds as well. Healthy disease-free transplants. We also recommend maintaining proper fertility. This fungus typically starts on older leaves that are reaching the end of their vegetative growth, usually, okay? Unless you get really favorable conditions where it can get onto younger leaves, okay? It's very similar to what we have issues with early blight, where it typically stops at the, starts at the bottom of the canopy, the bottom of the plant with the oldest leaves, and then moves up rapidly. Okay, so typically what we recommend is that if you maintain good fertility, you're not going to have as severe issues with it as if you are a little low on your nitrogen. And of course, last but not least is chemical control. There's been a lot of work that's been done in chemical control. A lot of this work is I'm showing here was done by Ken Pronesny before he retired from University of Florida. He did a lot of work showing that protective applications of chlorothalonil were necessary for control. Not only for foliar, but also for fruit. He also demonstrated the benefits of adding azoxystrobin and pyraclostrobin for disease control. And this is an important part here, is 2002 this work was done. And even in 2005, he found that applications of pyraclostrobin alternated with boscalid, or you can actually buy a formulation of the two put together called Pristine, gave the best control of all. And pretty much that became kind of the standard for most growers throughout South Florida is to either use a strobe or to use something like Pristine with the mixture between the boscalid or an SCHI with the strobilurin. So we're going to spring forward up to 2008, three years after Ken Pronesny did that work. I actually started up with the University of Florida and started doing some field trials as well. And right away we started noticing this is actually a early trial where we actually had both early blight and target spot in the trial. And right away, one of the first things we started noticing is that this is our, compared to our non-treated control, our QOI in the beginning gave some fairly good control, but over time it broke down. It really wasn't that effective. And keep in mind here, we're looking at both target spot and early blight. So these didn't really do very well, even compared to the chlorothalonil weekly application. And in this case with the QOI, we're actually rotating that every other week with chlorothalonil application to the canopy. And comparing that to some newer SDHIs or succinate dehydrogenase inhibitors like flupyrim down here, this is actually labeled as Luna now from Bayer, actually did really, really well. And so that really started making us question, well, what's going on here? And at the same time, we started seeing some larger outbreaks at grower locations where they had been using strobilurins and they were and pretty much had very little success actually controlling this pathogen. Of course, this coincided with a lot of new fungicides hitting the market. We had a number of new methionine biosynthesis inhibitors, such as Scala or Inspire Super, which would be pyrimethanil or ciprodenil mixed with difenoconazole. We also had some dimethylase inhibitors that came into the market, predominantly difenoconazole, which is actually in a couple of different formulations of Rivastop, Quadristop, and Inspire Super. And actually, the big group is probably the succinate dehydrogenase inhibitors. Products, chemicals such as pentheopyrad, flupyrim, and fluoxypyroxide, which have hit the market recently. These are, of course, the trade names. This is just kind of a table showing what I just presented before. You can see all these different groups. And this is very, very promising. What we're most concerned about, where were you sitting at? Okay.
2 minutes.
Okay. What we're most concerned about is some of these new SDHIs, other than the some of the issues we've seen with the strobes out in field trials, is a lot of these new SDHIs had very similar chemical structure, which of course raises the concern of cross-resistance occurring. So we started collecting isolates from throughout the state, started doing some testing, and to make a long story short, what we found is pretty much all the isolates, and we're over 20 isolates now that we've collected throughout the state. It's just a small collection, but it's fairly random from throughout the state. All of them have been extremely resistant to strobilurins, especially azoxystrobin, including pyraclostrobin. And some of them we've actually found are resistant to boscalid, which is kind of the older succinate dehydrogenase inhibitor material that originally hit the market. And some of those are actually showing some cross resistance with even some of the newer SDHIs that are in the market now. Okay, and keep in mind, at least with the strobes, you got to think again. You know, some of that work that was done previously by Ken Pronesny, you're only talking 10 years, less than that, really. I mean, a lot of this work was done in 2010, so you're talking 5-8 years, and we're already finding a huge resistance issues. We took a number of these isolates and started testing them in growth room trials. We actually took tomato transplants, treated them with the different chemistries, and then came in and actually inoculated them with a single isolate. In this case, we used an isolate that's SDHI sensitive, or it's sensitive to things like boscalid and pentheopyrad. And again, you see this, we're compared to our non-treated control here. We find that the multiple modes of action, such as the chlorothalonil and mancozeb, some did okay, not as great as we'd hoped for. The SEHIs did the most effect, did the best, but the QOIs here, you can see a complete breakdown with QOIs, and in this case, it actually made disease worse. If we looked at SDHI insensitive strains, you get kind of a different picture, where again, the SDHIs didn't do as well, except for flupyriram, which still did very, very well. Structurally, it's very different than the other SDHIs. And the QI, again, you saw the exact same trend, where the QI, the strobes, made disease worse. So that really reduces our, starts reducing our options that growers have for managing this disease. Of course, this wouldn't be valid without doing some field trials, and probably the one here, let's see what we got. All right. So essentially, this is a field trial where we did in 2011 where we used either an SDHI-sensitive strains or SDHI-resistant strains for inoculating the field. Okay, we have untreated controls. We have plots that are treated weekly with Bravo Weatherstick or chlorothalonil. We have other plots where we're actually using either Quadris, Fontellus, Endura, or Inspire Super, and these are actually in rotation with Bravo. So here you can see at least with the SDHI sensitive, the addition of the Quadris or the Zoxystrobin had no benefit at all at controlling this disease out in the field. And of course, we see exact same trend with SDHI resistant. The big difference comes when you start looking at the sensitive versus the resistant here. You can see, again, you get better control with the sensitive with the SDHIs versus the resistance. You start losing that control. So we're still getting some control from the chlorothalonil, but the nice thing to see is that we're not seeing an increase in disease. I'm going to jump all the way up to the...
You don't have to cut you off here.
Okay. So this is actually to really show the point where before I showed you we're actually doing these trials kind of rotating chemistry, specific chemistries with something like chlorothalonil. So this is actually a trial that's done by Matthews Perret up in North Florida, up in Quincy, where he actually looked at either using another DMI, flutriafol, versus mancozeb and azoxystrobin pyrimethanol with Escala and chlorothalonil, and basically just looking at weekly applications of these chemistries. And basically just to show you that, at least if you look under area under disease progress curve, a lot of these products did very, very well, except for the Quadris, and this is kind of one of those a picture says says a thousand words, a picture is worth a thousand words, where here is straight applications of Quadris versus Escala. So not only did the Quadris fail, but again, it totally exacerbated disease. So basically what we're doing now is we've changed a lot of our recommendations for growers and actually recommended to stay away from zoxystrobins. So for conclusions, Corynebsparra caseicola, it's genetically and phenotypically a diverse clonal pathogen, has extremely broad host range, with isolates ranging from saprophytic to pathogenic on specific hosts. There's definitely a lot of evidence for host specificity. Global distribution, of course, there's examples where these genotypes are moving around globally quite readily. But there is evidence that these isolates, even though they're moving around, have become adapted to the environment within that global location. Cult control will require integration of strategies. Of course, I've told you a lot of cultural sanitation and alternate hosts you'll have to manage. Chemical rotations with multiple modes of actions, fungicide resistance is a huge concern. And especially within the industry right now, we have a huge concern over premixes of Strobilurin QI fungicides. And not just for things like target spot, but other pathogens as well, where we know there's huge issues with QI fungicides. And of course, you know, all this up here with the genotyping and phenotyping becomes really important as we start looking for sources of resistance to Corynebsparra. And with that, I'll stop. Thank you.
Excellent. Appreciate that, Gary. We're going to have to hold the questions until the end, but Gary will be around here for a little while. And three things to take home from that is, first off, the importance of the diversity of the fungus. The second thing is that if you replaced tomato with the word cotton, I think those of us in Alabama and Georgia would say what he described for tomato is exactly the same as for cotton.